It's nice to meet you, Nick.
Nice to meet you too. And you pronounce your name Shiva Guide, right?
Yeah. Most of my patients just call me Dr. G
Dr. G.
because the last name has such a weird spelling. I should say a foreign spelling.
Sure. People, something people aren't used to. Well, yeah, I'm excited for this. I appreciate that you're willing to open up about it. You said you were willing to talk about anything, and I appreciate that.
You can ask me anything. Well, I have to practice what I preach, right? And I
Right.
preach to my patients that no secrets and don't hold back. So I absolutely cannot do that
Love it.
myself.
You do not avoid. You do not avoid. I can tell.
I do not avoid. I do
Yeah.
not avoid. So how did you find me anyway?
You know, I think it was after another shooting that happened sometime since 2017. And I was kind of seeking out someone who specializes and understands this. And you, of course, have a very unique understanding, firsthand and theoretical.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how uniquely equipped you are to talk about this.
I like to think so. I mean, I think we're all growing as therapists and constantly learning, but I know it definitely impacted the way that I teach my patients in some ways. So.
I notice you have this kind of orientation toward therapy, and you've even used the word psychoeducation. And just now, you saying the phrase teach my patients. I like that about you. I like that flavor. I think therapy should be educational.
It has to be actually, the field of psychology has changed quite a bit in the past century. And I mean, really, psychology, I would say, became kind of more popular probably in the middle of the last century. But, this idea of you come in and lay down on a couch, and people make jokes about it now, but it's the psychodynamic, it's there. Some people come from that orientation, but I think slowly that sort of approach is phasing out and it's being replaced by a much more active and very present-oriented therapy. We know that to help people change, we actually have to give them a foundation of change. And, the way I like to put it with my patients is that we're teaching them a new vocabulary. And with this new vocabulary, they have to learn a whole bunch of new words because we're trying to actually change the way that they think and the way that they process information. With the ultimate goal of having an alternative experience in their day, as it relates to themselves, the world, other people. So you can't really come into a therapy like that or a treatment program without orienting people. And so I always start off all kinds of therapy for all kinds of reasons with just basic education. Here are some words that I want you to learn. Here are some concepts I want you to learn, and here's some science that I want to teach you. I'm a big nerd, and I love to nerd out, and my patients know it, and they laugh about it. But I'll actually get them up on the whiteboard. I'll get up on the whiteboard, old school style, and I'll just outline all the structures in the brain. And for example, when we're having a fight, flight, freeze response, what is it happening down to the neurochemical and the structure in the brain? And something amazing happens when you educate people. Whether patient, client, or just layperson, the thing that happens is suddenly they feel like mental illness is a real physical issue and it destigmatizes it. I've had people leave my therapy room crying out of joy, saying things like, "So it's not all in my head. It's not well." And I'm like, "Well, actually, everything's in our head, right? Whether you're tired, you're cold, you're in love, you're hungry, it's all happening up here.
By the way.
Our stomach's not talking to us. Our lips aren't talking to us. They're sending signals, but it's really important for them to understand that the brain is an organ and it functions like every other organ, but side note, it's the most important organ because it actually runs the whole show. It runs all the other organs. And when we start to see a decompensation, you know, a neurochemical change in the brain, and we start to notice psychiatric distress, psychological symptoms, what happens is it affects every other part of our body. Mm. We start to lose sleep. And then once we have sleep problems, it impacts your cardiovascular system, your immune system, your metabolic system, and, you know, your ability to manage pain. So, you know, there's just this snowball effect. So when people think that mental illness is just in your head, I mean, it's really absurd. And so one of my just missions in life is to help teach people to think about this new perspective of, wait, the brain is an organ and we have to treat it like an organ. You know, an example I give, Nick, is that nobody goes into the cardiology department and negotiates treatment. You know, if the doctor says you need a stent or you need to take this medication for your blood pressure or whatever, people aren't like, no. Actually, yeah, I'll take it like 2 times a week. And yeah, I'm not willing to do that. And I'm not going to get the stent. I mean, people take it seriously. But why is it any different for the brain? And I'll tell you, I have folks coming in, they're like, doc, nope, sorry, I don't do groups. I don't know if I want weekly appointments. And then sometimes they're just not able or willing to do the homework. It's like, these are our tools. These are our medicines, right? And studies have shown that when you are on medication alone, you might have like a 50% improvement. If you're in therapy alone, another 50% improvement. When you put it together, we almost see a twofold improvement. So there's something synergistic when you put the two together. So, you know, I just encourage people to come from a perspective of being psychologically minded and intelligently able to speak about brain health, right? Brain dis-ease is no different than any other dis-ease of any other organ system. So education is a really, really fundamental part of everything I do with patients, whether I'm educating them about sleep or educating them about medications. I'm the hugs doc, not the drugs doc, right? I kind of left the dark side. But, you know, and so I have nothing to gain one way or the other than the improvement of my patients. But I try to explain the physiology and the way that medications work and how they impact the brain so that I can maybe encourage them to adhere to the recommendations that their psychiatrists make for them or their primary care doctors. So education is just critical. I mean, I don't think you can do really good work with people without educating. And I think just in general, the general population, knowing the why and the how helps you then decide, make an informed decision about what you're willing to do or not.
Knowing the why and the how, yes. We're just gonna keep going here. And so yes, I'm here with Dr. Shiva Guide, who's a clinical psychologist, still based in San Diego, right?
I am. I'm licensed in California and nationally board certified, but based here in San Diego.
Yes, and we're here to talk about a variety of things, including your personal experience surviving the Route 91 mass shooting, and then your understanding of how to heal and the way you've gone through your own healing process and helped other people heal and established a community of survivors. It's a really beautiful story, and I'm grateful that you're here to tell it. I'll just share a few thoughts on everything you were just sharing. I it's really interesting, you know, because I think there have been many false theories about what is malfunctioning in the brain that have turned some people off to any explanation that is neurological for why a person's experiencing what they're experiencing. I mean, when you look far back enough, we had ridiculous things, you know, that like toxins were being stored in organs, and so we need to perform organ removal to take the toxins out, and just totally wrong things. And I think in many cases, you know, even the chemical imbalance narrative is not what's really going on, or we haven't confirmed that that's what's going on yet. for everything psychological, there is something biological, and there will always be neurological correlates going on in the brain. And I like what you said about the way it destigmatizes a person's condition when they think of it in biological terms. And along with that, I think it, or part of that, is that it makes them feel like it's not their fault also.
That's right. So that's right. That's an excellent point.
I think that's really helpful. And then on just a comment on therapy and education, it's interesting because I come from the perspective of being a professor, and I've definitely noticed how therapeutic education can be. And then you're coming from the perspective of understanding how educational therapy can be. It's beautiful. And we kind of
100%. You know, yeah. I love that you're, that you, I mean, I think we're kindred spirits in this sense. And obviously you're a professor. I teach, even though I'm not formally a professor. Most of my patients will say, yeah, it feels like I'm in a college class or maybe a graduate level class. Mm. And I think the important part of that is that, you know, traditionally there's been this rift, this distinction between the patient and the doctor. And, you know, it's almost as though the information and knowledge about medicine is proprietary and, you know, a patient wouldn't understand. And I have patients that, you know, that give this feedback that say, nobody's ever taught me this. Nobody's ever explained this to me. Some of it is that, let's face it, we're all, you know, overstretched. There's a huge shortage in mental health providers in this country, and we're in the midst of a mental health crisis. But once you teach people, you know, they also feel empowered by this knowledge, and they feel confident in their ability to make changes, because when you really break things down, they start to recognize just how much of their improvement lies in their own control, in their own hands. You know, if you think about it, the stigma that we've been fighting for a century, probably, it really just comes from fear. And if you think about, well, where does fear come from? Fear comes from ignorance, right? And ignorance, you know, some people might think that's an insult. It's not. It's just a word saying lack of knowledge, right? Stating lack of knowledge. There is a lack of knowledge. Some of that is that this is not universally taught and it's not spoken of. And so that just perpetuates that secrecy and that shame and that guilt, and all of these myths and misconceptions and misunderstandings are perpetuating the stigma. But there's also truly a lack of knowledge. I mean, psychology and psychiatry are fairly new fields. I mean, they have their roots, you know, in over a century ago, right? Aristotle's and Socrates, right. You know. Even our Socratic questioning method, it goes way back. But the truth is, the brain is a scary organ because it does so much and we don't understand most of it. You know, I mean, I would say probably in terms of the science of that organ, we're probably in, you know, infant stages. Mm-hmm. And who knows, in another 100 years, if we're all still here, I mean, we won't be, but, right. you know, who knows what the understanding of the brain will be, but definitely that fear comes from ignorance. And so I feel that that's one way that we can, you know, first of all, help people understand it's not their fault, but it is their responsibility to take care of their brain, just like it is their responsibility to take care of other parts of their health. So I could not agree more.
Beautiful. Well, I feel that I should kind of prepare the audience for what might be a very intense story. I can say that, well, let me just emphasize that you wrote the book, Route 91, Healing from Mass Violence and Trauma, and you just gave us all a gift by making it available for free online to download. So thank you for that. And reading it, the first chapter or two where you talked about what happened, was the most... the strongest vicarious experience I've had of that incident. And I've listened to people tell their story and I've seen some footage and done my best to imagine, but reading your first person point of view brought me into it on another level. So, and it was really intense, but an extremely important story to hear. And then, so however comfortable you are in this moment to open up about what happened, please feel free to share with us.
I so appreciate that. And I'm very touched that you took the time to read the book. You know, it's a pretty easy 100 page read. It was intended as a teaching tool and as a starting point for people who may feel stigmatized and who also may not understand all of their symptoms. Let's face it, with social media and Google and all of these search engines, there is a plethora, an abundance of resources and information. However, having said that, not all of the information is actually helpful. And so, you know, having a specialization in trauma and anxiety disorders, which also then includes mood and everything that kind of hangs with that, it was really important to me to try to reach as many people as quickly as possible with at least tip of the iceberg, you know, introductory ideas, so they can understand their symptoms if they were having some, to understand the mechanism by which trauma develops and the path of healing, which is within reach for everybody, right, who is willing to listen and willing to learn. But it really was intended as a tool. I appreciate hearing from you that reading my account was helpful. At least there was enough there to put you at the shooting. The interesting story, backstory with that is, you know, when I came back the day after, it's the details are so jumbled up and the chronology was just all out of order, which is very common for people who experience something traumatic, that, you know, I just basically got down on my computer, sat down and just started typing everything I could remember. When I was preparing the book at close to 1 year, and I thought, well, this is a really good time to now put this out, because the 1 year anniversaries, you know, in my work with trauma folks, it can be very triggering. People don't really know how to spend an anniversary. And so I just wanted to see if there were people that had been hiding and avoiding for that whole year, if we could kind of get the word out. But my mom, who's my best friend, she's a brilliant writer and, taught me how to write. And so she was kind of my editor, and she helped me read countless versions of this story and really helped me kind of get it down from like 10 single spaced, you know, condensed, just dense pages to a pretty short story. So you should have seen it before with all the detail. It was very disjointed. And, you know, because this is a teaching tool, you know, it was helpful to have my mom to say, you know, that extra detail doesn't really add to for the purpose of the book, you know. So she helped me kind of simplify and turn that into a very concise story. But having said that, I'm very happy that you could kind of get that vicarious experience to see, you know, even a glimpse of what that was like just by reading it. You know, I think you can summarize the whole night with two words, horrific and terrifying. That's probably the best way to describe it. And, you know, I mean, all, you know, the important details are in there if people want to go and refer to that. I'm happy to tell you what happened. I'd say if I were to kind of summarize, you know, after the news clips sort of came out for that week or so, I think the whole story just kind of died, right? Very suspiciously just died after a week. But there were these news stories that were, you know, just harping on 10 or 11 minutes of shooting, right? Which of course was not at all the experience that we had. You know, first of all, when people are in those kinds of experiences, whether it's rape or combat or natural disaster or child abuse, although that can be sometimes a prolonged experience, all of these types of traumatic events feel much longer than they are, right? And there are some very good reasons for that. It's almost like time kind of slows down. So, you know, I couldn't tell you how many minutes I thought it was going on, but it felt like much more than 10 minutes. The other thing is, it wasn't just simply a shooting that went on for 10 minutes. You know, we were at this concert And by the time we all, most people even realized that this wasn't fireworks and it wasn't confetti poppers and it wasn't part of the show, we were already into the second volley of gunfire, right? It really wasn't until the lights, stage lights went off, Jason Aldean like grabbed his wife and ran because bullets started hitting the stage. That it was really not until the floodlights in the sort of the front portion of the venue, exactly where I was, on the Mandalay Bay side up by the stage on all that turf area. It was standing room, right? Thankfully, the people who were in wheelchairs and with families and children were in the very back of the venue, which was closest to the exit. And I think most of them, just when the lights went on, they knew something was wrong, they exited and didn't experience what those of us in the front, because we kind of got stuck there, at least most of us. And so, you know, then there was the, you know, 11 minutes of shooting, which of course, you know, we had no idea, was it going to end? You know, I just recall crouched down kind of at the edge of a plastic table behind a motorized wheelchair that had, I kept thinking, okay, it's got to have a steel back. Like, please don't hit my neck. Please don't hit my jugular. Please don't hit anything vital. I was just waiting to get shot. I mean, the gunshots sounded like they were coming from different places. There were some that were very far off. There were some that were literally, I was expecting to see someone come over the fence. It was that close. And so, you know, then there would be a volley, then there would be a break, then there would be a volley, then there would be a break. And, you know, when there was finally a break that was a little bit longer, and of course that ended up being the end of the volleys, the end of the gunfire, some sort of secondary group of people that I had ended up stuck there with, we just decided to run, right? And you know, I think the fascinating thing is that I don't have full memories of all of this, and that's very typical of people who experience trauma as well. But, you know, just to summarize, it was like 2.5 hours of running and hiding. Right. So this 10 minutes of shooting didn't quite summarize what happened. You know, the other interesting thing is everybody there had a completely different experience. Like, truly, depending on where you were and depending on whether you were shot, you were injured, somebody near you was shot, everybody had a completely unique experience. But, you know, how do I know it was 2.5 hours? I was not checking my watch. All I know is the shooting started about 10. And by the time they herded us into a conference room, after running and hiding to multiple places around the strip, you know, rolling under cars and running into one side of the building, you know, running out because a mass of people, you know, covered with dirt and blood and everything, are screaming, the shooters are coming, right? Then again, expecting to die. By the time I got into the conference room, I looked at my Fitbit and it was 12:30. Right. And I was kind of shocked about that, too, because I remember thinking, holy, are we allowed to use profanity?
Yeah, no censorship necessary. Go right ahead.
I mean, I remember just thinking, holy shit, like 2.5 hours. What the fuck was going on for 2.5 hours? It felt like longer than 10 minutes, but it felt like you have no sense of time. Right. And so, and then of course, once we were in the conference room for like 5 to 6 hours, we're all stuck in there freezing to death. And I mean, that was probably partly the shock of having gone through everything. And we're all in, you know, it was beautiful weather in Vegas. We're all in not a lot of clothing, and we're in this super air conditioned room and scared to death. And, you know, we're getting text messages, bomb threats. They find bomb materials at the airport right next to where we were. I mean, it was a whole night. This wasn't just 10 minutes. And I think that people who weren't there and just hear about this incident, this massacre, just don't really have a way of understanding that. You know, it wasn't just a moment of fear. It was an entire night and multiple moments of truly terror. And there are snapshots that I have through that night. And these were the moments that I truly thought this was it. I was, that was the end. I was going to die. You know, the first moment was when we had, you know, decide, well, after the second volley, the lights went on and me and a bunch of people that were around me went forward. The two girlfriends I was there with, they just disappeared. I mean, everybody got separated from who they were sitting right next to or standing right next to. And thankfully, I think before the shooting was even over, they made it back to the room, although not without injury, because one of my friends, in crawling over one of those food truck or grills, burned her leg badly. I mean, so, you know, there were all kinds of just random things. They said that when they were running off the venue, the girl right next to them got shot in the neck. And I kept thinking, holy cow, if I had followed them out, that could have been me that got shot. Cause I, you know, they were a little younger than me. I tended to be the mama bear and like be behind everybody. And so, you know, we kind of moved towards the stage. I couldn't tell you like how far we moved, but we kind of went up to as close to the side of the stage. I mean, we didn't know what was going on. All we knew is that something was coming from sort of the direction of the Mandalay Bay and the air, right? Or somewhere in, you know, coming not from like somebody next to you, for example. Mm-hmm. We couldn't see anything. And I remember being crouched down just like it was yesterday and really thinking that I was going to get shot and just praying that it wasn't going to hit anything vital. I was convinced that this was going to be it. And then, you know, there were moments of denial when I kept thinking that this is not happening. This cannot be happening. But then thinking, shit, this is happening. But this has to stop. At some point, it's got to be over. Either I'm going to die, we're going to die, we're going to all die, or it's just got to stop at some point. This can't go on forever. And then when there was that break and we started running, all I can recall, Nick, is taking a couple of steps and seeing just an enormous pool of blood. And that was the next moment when I thought, oh my God, I just had this thought, holy shit, people are really dying, right? It's like it was coming in and out of the realization that this was a life-threatening situation, right? But it's just so terrifying and horrific and unexpected and unpredictable that, you know, there's a part of your brain that's like, no, this cannot possibly be happening, right? People who've been through trauma understand this. At that point, something very interesting happened. And, you know, this kind of was a wonderful thing in a sense, because going through this experience myself, although it wasn't the first trauma I've had in my life, it was certainly the most recent and tangible. And of course, as a therapist now with expertise in trauma. And I really, in then subsequently trying to help the community, I went and did a lot of research and found new ways to teach my patients about trauma and help people, you know, in the Route 91 survivor community, as well as other survivor communities for all kinds of traumas, just better understand why some of these things happen, right? And so the interesting thing that happened is after that pool of blood, I just blocked out. The next few seconds or minutes, I couldn't even tell you, because my memory is like pristine green turf. That's my memory. But a few weeks later, we saw a picture of what we were maneuvering over. And I specifically came back from Vegas using the word, yeah, I remember maneuvering. I was talking to somebody who was there with me, and he said, you know, do you remember what happened? And I said, you know, snapshots. I remember maneuvering off the turf. Well, I mean, it was pretty, that's just an understatement. It was incredibly disturbing to see this photo. And, you know, I looked at it a few times. I haven't looked at it since. It was, and I, you know, I shared it with my mom at one point. She's just, you know, it gives you the EBGBs. It's just the turf littered with beer cans, belongings, hats, shoes, you know, garbage, everything. And So that was what we were maneuvering over. And, you know, I remember almost tripping, and I remember cotton mouth like I've never experienced in my life, right? Which is a very, very classic fight, flight, freeze response. It's one of those physiological symptoms when we're having that fear response. All animals experience these things. And the next thing I remember, very bizarre, right, is because of that cotton mouth, there was some guy behind the vending area in the mid venue throwing out bottles of water to people that were running. It was the most irrelevant random, but at the moment it wasn't irrelevant because I had cotton mouth. I couldn't breathe, right? And so any animal's first priority is to survive, right? But for example, that part of the experience then became a way, using my own personal example, to share and teach people why we remember certain pieces of a traumatic experience, but not the whole story typically, right? And it has to do with a protein that is released in the brain called the ARC protein, released by the hippocampus, which kind of is the roommate of your amygdala. It takes notes, and it's kind of noting like everything it's in experiencing in the environment. Why? Just in case we're ever in this situation again, right? Mm-hmm. The animal mind wants to remember this. And so we believe that protein drives home any kind of memories, usually at the height of your hyper arousal and those moments that you probably think you're going to die. And it sends it to long-term memory storage, right? And why is that significant? Because down the line, when you start having trauma symptoms, right, whether they go away, which most of the time they do and they resolve, or whether they stick around, that's what becomes the source of these intrusive images, these intrusive memories, these intrusive visuals, you know, the flashbacks. That's what that comes from. And so explaining this again from a very intellectual, academic perspective helps people understand, oh, that's why I can't remember everything. And those snapshots are like driven into my brain, you know, like nobody's business. You know, also explaining cognitive neuroscience. Why don't we remember certain things? Why, you know, one thing that bothered me, Nick, was that to this day, I don't remember all the bodies, right? I remember seeing people being carried at the very beginning of the first few volleys, but I turned to one of my friends. I said, oh, they must be drunk and they're just carrying them. No, they were dead. But my brain couldn't connect that because I didn't have the information. But there's actually a really logical reason. Well, there are two possible explanations for why we don't remember everything. And cognitive neuroscience, which is fascinating and complex, explains this to us. In order for things to be stored in memory, we have to be able to attend to something. But also, we have to be able to use language, and we have to label it, right? If you don't label something with human language, then it can't go into storage. So that's one problem. Because if you think about it, the human brain can only focus on so much when you're in a life-threatening situation. So what do you think the human brain is going to focus on? What would you guess?
That the brain would focus on any relevant cues of danger?
Exactly. It will focus on things that are immediately relevant and necessary to the animal's survival. So if you take a step back, as just awful and repulsive as this sounds, are dead bodies necessary for my survival? Wow. Belongings, anything not moving, my brain is possibly not even going to label it and then therefore not going to store it. So that's one possible explanation, but there's another one. When we are in a hyper-aroused state, it's almost as though we are now on the 10th floor of a building and we're storing memories at that hyper-aroused state, right? There's something in social psychology they talk a lot about called state-dependent learning. And it means that whatever state you're in when you're learning something, you will have better recall when you're in that state, right? And so, of course, you do something like this, and then you come back down to the ground floor, And so when you try to look for those memories, you can't find them because they're stored on the 10th floor, right? In that file cabinet up there. And so sometimes people can get re-triggered when they have then again another life threatening situation, what a fight, flight, freeze response is called when there is no lion, right? So, you know, going through some of those experiences gave me a kind of a richer experience or a richer understanding of what a lot of my patients who've been through trauma experience, and a lot of new ways to explain it. Because I found, you know, in starting the support group for the Route 91 community, I found myself needing to find new ways to explain a lot of this science in lay terms. And I like to use a lot of analogies and stories to kind of bring it all together so that not only is learning fun, but the understanding sticks with people. Yeah. And so that was a lot of what I did. So back to what happened that night after we then made it past that pool of blood and the maneuvering and all of the stuff I've blocked out to some extent. We ended up halfway back from the venue. We're still not at the exit. And we crawled over food trucks and just kind of waited there. And that was another pretty scary time because, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen. No, we were cut off. We were just waiting for a police officer or somebody with authority. And finally, somebody did come and said, you know, in very plain terms, get the fuck out, get the fuck out, get off the venue. And, you know, we were the last group of people probably stuck on the venue. And we were herded, you know, into this concourse with all these glass shopping stores or whatever. And you know, it was like a moment to breathe, but Nick, that was another moment that I just was waiting to see shooters and waiting to die. We were crouched down. Then, you know, next thing you know, a mass of people running down the concourse, you know, screaming bloody murder, you know. So of course, some of us followed suit and went back out onto the streets. And then, you know, along with another group of people, including an off-duty LAPD officer, we rolled under trucks and whatever we could in the parking lot until more police came up to that area screaming, get back in the building. I mean, it was chaos, right? It was complete chaos and confusion, and it was terrifying. I think by the time I got in the room, Nick, in the conference room, I was like, fuck it. If it's my time, it's my time. I mean, like, we've been running and hiding for 2.5 hours. What am I going to do? If there's a bomb, there's a bomb. You can't outrun a bomb, you know? And then I spent that 5 or 6 hours really worried about my patients because they knew I was at the concert. Because I had to cancel that day of groups, which happened to be my trauma groups, ironically. So, you know, I was worried. And I kept thinking, wow, like, how am I going to get through this? I'm going to have to recover from this if I have any symptoms, which I'm a doctor. I'm specialized. I'm not going to have any symptoms. I know how to get through this, right? But the brain does what it does. And, you know, I didn't develop PTSD because I know how to not develop PTSD, but I did have trauma symptoms, some that lasted even for a year, you know, like the intrusive images, the intrusive memories, but mostly the intrusive images, right? From those moments, like under the truck, thinking I'm going to die in a fucking truck. I'm going to die on my stomach under a fucking truck, right? Those were the moments that I would just get glimpses. It's like I'd be driving and then suddenly I see a pool of blood, or I'd be teaching my patients about something else. Like, we're talking about relationships. And then the next thing you know, I'm crouched down. So, you know, that's what happens. But yeah, by the time I was in the conference room, I was really thinking strategically, like, what are we going to do here? Right. What are we going to do? And I decided, you know, I mean, I survived. I need to just go back to work because my patients are worried. And, you know, many, like 50, 60 people called the clinic. People were trying to find me on Facebook. I didn't have an account at the time, but I had LinkedIn. Just like, doc, are you okay? You know? Yeah, there were 22,000 people. Like, what's the chance? Most people survived, right? Some of my patients killed me off. They're like, I knew you were going to be dead. I'm just happy I met you. Mm-hmm. You know, so you know, it was a very emotional week when I came back, and some of my patients broke down crying. My combat folks felt horrible. They were so upset that I had gone through that. I mean, and I kept thinking when we're in the conference room, wow. So my patients, like, can you imagine if I had died? And, like, you know, they'd have this story that just assimilated on top of their story of the world is not safe. And my trauma doctor went and got killed. Right. I mean, it's like I felt like all the recovery and all the progress we'd made would have been sort of negated. So, yeah. You know, it was a very conscious decision that I was going to be extremely transparent and completely authentic and open. And if I needed to cry, I would cry, which I did. I did a few times in groups, you know, especially the first couple of days. And then when there was the shooting in Los Angeles, up at the Borderline Bar, that was incredibly triggering for a number of reasons. And I had to actually leave work, and, you know, because I broke down after one of my patients said, "Doc G, are you okay?" You know, and I had been bombarded with news channel calls all morning because some of the one person that died was a survivor of Route 91. And what are the chances that you're going to be in two mass shootings in a year, you know? So, you know, I looked at this patient. I said, no, I'm not okay. I'm not okay. Because statistically, how the fuck does somebody go through two mass shootings in a year? Like, this is not okay. This is not the direction that our society should be going in, not to shoot on people, but this is not the direction we want to go in. And so I had to just excuse myself. And I said, you know, let's cancel group for today. I went to my division office. I said, you know what? I got to go home. I'm sorry. I got to go up to my family. I can't be here, you know, because I also have to lead by example. And I wanted to teach my patients, it's okay to set a boundary and it's okay to know that you're not okay and you need to take a time out and be compassionate to yourself and be mindful. So, you know, that whole concept of the book was, and the reason I even put my story in there, was it because I really needed to share my story? Not really, because I never avoided to begin with. Anybody who asked me, not once since October 1st, 2017, did I ever say, I don't feel like talking about it. Never once, because I know that's the beginning of the end. It's the nail in the coffin. So I never avoided. But, you know, I put it in the book because, again, you can't force people to buy into mental health and all of these ideas that we teach. You have to lead by example. And I wanted to show people, hey, yeah, I'm a, you know, almighty doctor, you know, we put us on pedestals, but I'm a human. And I went through this and it was fucked up. And I had a lot of symptoms afterwards. And I had massacre nightmares and I had intrusive images and I was hypervigilant. And I broke down crying more times in public places than I can even count. But we can get through this. And here's how I healed. And here's how the community healed. And now, here are some simple bucket rules that you can use for the rest of your life. And here's some tips. And so that you fully understand what trauma is and specifically what PTSD is, right? Because we have a lot of misconceptions about that and we can get into that later. But that was the night. And then, you know, after the somber walk back to the hotel room, it was like 15 people in the room and only two of them did I know. So everybody just kind of ended up wherever they ended up that night. Which was kind of a beautiful thing, right? It shows us that we thrive and survive. And also, I believe we recover, you know, through and in and with those human relationships with other people. Mm-hmm. So you can ask me any questions you'd like about that night. I'm sure this probably raised some questions, and I'm sorry, I'll try to breathe more and stop. Mm-hmm. But when I get on a roll, I get pretty passionate.
So. I'll let you roll. That's for sure. So. Yeah, I mean, I even, as I was reading, I took note of some of the key words. I sort of coded it as though I was a researcher reading a narrative. And you mentioned many of these words, but just to kind of, I almost think of these as like colors on a palette and then mix those colors together and get a sense of the experience. You use terror, terrified, helpless, stunned, desperate, shocked, confusing, disbelief, sickening, incomprehensible. I mean, just the strongest.
Wow, I love that. You know, I didn't even remember using all those words.
Yeah, they were.
Books since I posted it. Mm. But yeah, wow, a lot of really, really intense words.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And it just kind of gave me the sense of you're really selecting the strongest words we have available to us. And I imagine that probably even those words seem to fall short of exactly what it was really like. So
you're absolutely right. I mean, even hearing those, I'm like, wow, it was actually kind of worse than that. Yeah. You know, I don't think that the human language necessarily can capture everything perfectly.
Right.
But I did my best, right? Mm. I did my best. Mm.
One question, kind of a specific one. It was interesting what you were talking about regarding the memory of the traumatic event. And I liked a lot of ways that you explained that, including bringing in the state-dependent memories and the way that, you know, our perception is just so primed to focus on immediate threats and anything else, even if it is gruesome, like a dead body on the ground, it's just not kind of selected for in the moment and therefore not really remembered. Because I guess you could say only that which is consciously perceived can be remembered.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So one question I have is, in the process of healing afterward, how often, if ever, did memories come to your mind kind of for the first time? I imagine there was just bits that came back to you over time. So did you have those types of experiences of memories coming up that you were sort of remembering for the first time?
So that's a really good question. And, you know, it's funny that you ask that, because in some of the, you know, I was very transparent with my patients when I came back and I said, you know, we're all going to heal together, because like this thing I went through was pretty awful. So we're just going to roll up our sleeves and like get through this. And you read the book, so you remember what I came home to, or what it came back to work with. It was Halloween, right? Mm-hmm. So like every possible exposure. It was like, you know, somebody, higher power was placing these experiences to say, Shiva will heal. We will force her to heal for the community and herself and everybody, all her patients, because I couldn't have like fabricated, I couldn't have put these events and these things together even, you know, better than they were, than they showed up in my life. But some of my patients asked me, they said, are you scared, Dr. G? Are you scared that you're going to suddenly have memories? And I had to tell them, no, I'm not, because, you know, it's quite possible that they're there. It's also quite possible they're not there, because I may not have labeled, and they might just have not been, you know, in the moment. The human brain can only focus on so many pieces of information. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, I don't think I had any new memories come up. Mm-hmm. Pretty much what I remember is what I remember. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about memory that we have to keep in mind is that memory is dynamic. And so there's a lot of research in cognitive neuroscience that has taught us that when we store our first memory of an experience, it actually changes a little bit every time you pull it out of memory and you talk about it, think about it, write about it, process it, and then you put it back in storage, right? So there are the obvious storage and retrieval issues. Mm-hmm. But even at, let's say, in an ideal set of circumstances where you stored it in a way that is easily retrieved, it's different every time. So I think the thing that happened was that after the incident, you know, the memories were the memories, but I kept processing them in different stages, in different ways. And now looking back, you know, it is a very emotional thing talking about it. And that's very healthy. It would be probably not so good if I were completely emotionally detached from it. But at the same time, it's not triggering. And I don't have these sort of physiological, you know, experience of being back there. It's, I'm able to talk about it because I've talked about it so much, and I've, you know, I wrote it out, and I went back to Vegas probably 15 times in the year after the event, specifically with the goal of not only helping the folks in Las Vegas, you know, and start the groups up there about 4 months after we had started ours in San Diego, but also to just specifically to expose myself so that I knew I was definitely recovering. I'm actually going back to Vegas in October again. And the past couple of times I've been back last year, obviously because of COVID, nobody could go anywhere. But the October before that, and the one even before that, even the one in late October that was just after the 1 year anniversary, I literally went to Vegas. And I think there was one fleeting thought like, oh, the hotel this morning is really quiet, kind of like that morning. But that was it. Like, I literally went to Vegas, enjoyed the weekend, and never thought about Route 91, right? And that's recovery. It is. It's extraordinary. Even I think, wow, that's extraordinary. Like, we flew over the Mandalay Bay, and, you know, I went to the memorial. I didn't even think about it, right? But that's the natural progression after trauma. Most people actually do recover, and that's the most common outcome. But there are a handful of people that get stuck. So, you know, the thing that for me kept changing was just processing it with a new perspective. And, you know, at this point, as strange as this might sound, I'm very grateful for the experience. I'm very grateful that I was there because I was able to help a lot of people. As you said, as you pointed out, you know, if you do the statistics, and I have to go look back in my book, but, you know, there's for every certain number of people, there's one therapist, right, in this country. Like, statistically, if you do the math, there might have been, for 22,000, I think it would have been like maybe 5 or 6 psychologists at the venue, right? Unless somehow country music specifically selects for psychologists, right? So there might have been 6 psychologists max. But that's assuming all 6 of those psychologists for that 22,000 people love country music and happen to be at the Route 91 festival and stay that last night. And so I kept thinking, wow, I think I'm it, you know? Right. And like, I am obligated. I survived this. I was in the middle of the cesspool and I survived. People behind, there were a group of girls behind us. We found out they got shot. I mean, like 2 feet away from us, behind us. And, you know, it was just thinking about it just gives me the chills. But I thought, you know, wow, I mean, how perfect that me, psychologist, trained, specialized in trauma and combat trauma, you know, as well as other kinds of trauma, it doesn't get better than that, right? I mean, I have this knowledge. And so obviously I was not going to make money on surviving a massacre, right? So of course all the resources are free, but I was just hoping that we could get more resources out to more people. So I also, you know, set up a Facebook account just so that we could make announcements and send the links. And my friend Taylor Winston, who was the Marine that commandeered, stole the truck and took a couple dozen people to the hospital. He helped set that up, and there were a few other people that really helped out. So, and then once we got everybody coming to the support group, everybody, you know, I kept on driving home the point that one of the things that maintains our sense of happiness and well-being is random acts of kindness. Mm-hmm. So do random acts of, so people became very just supportive and altruistic, giving to the community. And I'll tell you, all the people that came to that group, they're better. And some of them are healthier than they even were before the Route 91 festival, you know? So, you know, it was a wonderful process, and it just highlights this idea that we heal in groups, and so we're social animals and we can't heal well in isolated bubbles, you know? I've sort of moved on to other, you know, charity and volunteer work and stuff. So I and also with COVID, and then our local dance hall and saloon in cahoots closed here in San Diego. So it kind of changed the country community a little bit. So things have been a little out of whack. But, you know, I'll go back and country dance some more when things kind of normalize. But, you know, I know a lot of people in the community are very connected to the people they met in the support group I started. So, you know, we had a lot of people rotate through that group and drive down an hour to come. And really, it wasn't about me or the group. It was about connecting with other survivors. And I was just a tour guide, you know. I was just a tour guide saying, hey, let's talk about this. Let's think about this. Stop. Don't avoid, you know. And it's a beautiful thing because all these people that have now recovered who may or may not have, but, you know, they were able to stay on the path of recovery. They paid it forward and they still pay it forward, you know, and they reach out every time there's a new mass shooting. I see posts on the Facebook pages of all the Route 91 survivor groups, and they are reaching out and they're sharing the resource. They're sharing the book or other resources. Mine is not the only one. But I think that's, you know, best case scenario. I started the group because that week that we came back, I heard nothing. Nothing. And it was a week that felt like a month, you know, again, because of what we were all still in a state of shock. And I started to panic towards the end of that week. I was like, there's no resources. 22,000 people, you know, 30% of that are going to develop PTSD. Are you kidding me? Like, there's no way this country has and of course, you know, I can only do so much. I can only do so much, but at least I could serve the San Diego area, you know, and the surrounding areas. And, you know, it's the best we can do, right?
So I want to really dive into the process of healing, what it feels like as an individual, how it relates to everything you just talked about in doing it in relationship. You said something there where some people are even healthier than they were before. And so that's a good cue for talking about post-traumatic growth. Yep. But before we get into all that, I have one more question about the event or the experience, which was, what was it like for your mom?
You know, it's interesting. And my sister, because she was actually texting me. She was the only person awake at the time. And she had been, I think she was putting in patient notes herself. And this news thing came across the screen, and she told me that her first thought was, oh, thank God Shiva's not there. She came home. But then her next thought was, oh shit, Shiva's still there. And so then she was like trying to call me, and I didn't answer because that was when we were running. And that was one of the points that we were running. And then when I rolled under the truck, you know, she started texting, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm under a truck. She's like, why are you under a truck? And I'm like, because the shooters were out in the streets, they were coming at us. And then, you know, she's like, get back in the building. And I said, I don't know if it's safe, you know? So she was kind of following me for the next, you know, hour or two. My mom was sleeping, thank God. My dad was out of the country at the time, thank God. And I just sent a text before my phone died. I sent a text to my mom saying, Mom, I'm okay. You're going to wake up and hear this news, but I'm okay. I'm in the conference room now, and I'll text you when I'm back in the room, and I'll text you when I'm at the airport. So, you know, I stayed in touch with them. My mom is a very optimistic person. Her major in college was psychology. So she taught me. I think she groomed me to be a psychologist, but she just said, you know, I was just happy that you were okay. Right. I suspect maybe it would have been a somewhat different experience had she been awake at that time watching the news. But, you know, and again, I didn't watch the news because I was in it. I was in the experience. So I only saw what was posted through that week. But my mom, every time I have asked her about it, she's just, I'm glad you're alive. It wasn't your time. My dad, when he found out, you know, months and months later, he said, well, it wasn't your time. Wow. My sister, this was very stressful for her. And I asked her, you know, I mean, that first couple of months, I was just trying to just get my head straight. And at some point I told her, I said, you know, I never asked you how you're doing, because this must be really upsetting. I mean, you know, at least I was able to run. You were just on the other line, completely helpless, and not able to do anything and just waiting by the phone. You know, it's a terrible, terrible position to be in. And this came up a lot in the support group we were running, because it was open not just to survivors, but to their friends and family, mm-hmm. because there were a lot of people at the time on the other end mm-hmm. that were going through this, but feeling completely helpless. My sister kind of hasn't wanted to really talk about it. I remember at the 1 year anniversary asking her if she wanted to come with me and saying, I really love if you come with me. And she's like, no, just kind of avoidant of the whole thing. So, you know, that's, we all have our ways of coping, and it is what it is, right? I won't judge it. It's just people have different ways of, so my sister is much as kind of an introvert, and, I'm an extrovert, if you can't already tell. Mm-hmm. We're just kind of on two ends of a spectrum. Mm-hmm. We're very close. We're very, very close and close in age, but very different in our personalities. And mm-hmm. I'm very, very emotionally vulnerable and self-disclosing and open about these kinds of things. But the rest of my family really isn't, mm-hmm. right? I don't want to call them emotionally constipated, but in, you know, like many people on the earth, not everybody's comfortable talking about feelings or really digging in. So that's okay. I'm kind of the black sheep in the family in that mm-hmm. sense.
So,
and I appreciate you asking that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, interestingly, I'm from Gilroy, and a couple of years ago there was a shooting at the Gilroy Garlic Festival.
I remember that.
Yes. And
there were actually a few Route 91 survivors there.
Oh my gosh.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah,
it's like
it really is.
Really unfathomable, you know?
Wow. And I wasn't there, but I easily could have been. And my brothers had just left, and my sister-in-law and her mom were there. So, you know, I had some version of my own experience of having family in that situation. And you're right that it does make a big difference whether you know that they're already okay before you even hear it happened versus when you're tracking the experience and you don't know if they're okay. That I also had the experience of kind of knowing they were okay by the time I found out that it happened. So,
but it can be very terrifying, you know, and we know now that PTSD can even be vicarious. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if somebody close to you goes through one of these events, you can develop PTSD. And when you understand really what PTSD, it makes a lot of sense, because PTSD is just this disorder that develops because we start telling a story. And then because of that story, we start behaving differently, mostly avoiding. And so once you change that, the PTSD can resolve. But, you know, you don't just have to have experienced something firsthand to develop PTSD. In fact, you know, parents whose children get molested often, especially if they have a sensitive brain, you know, and they're biologically and genetically predisposed to mental illness, they could easily develop PTSD from that. Mm-hmm. And I've had people who have experienced that. Mm.
Tell me why you chose to expose yourself and what the value of intentionally exposing yourself to conditioned stimuli is, and why you so strongly emphasize the importance of do not avoid.
Okay, great question. So you will appreciate, as a professor, you will appreciate my very academic answer for this. So one of the other things I make sure to teach all of my patients, anybody who's developed any kind of chronic mental illness, whether it's trauma or anxiety or depression, because it all kind of works the same way. But I teach them classical conditioning. So Pavlov, you know, the steak, the bells, salivation. And, you know, that is, it plays such an important role in the development of chronic psychiatric illness. Essentially, with trauma especially, you know, there's this fight, flight, freeze response initially, right? I mean, assuming that you perceive danger, because there is actually danger. So we're talking about an actual dangerous, life-threatening situation. And that's a hardwired response of all animals. So, you know, we have, to use the words that you just brought up and keep this very clinical and academic, which I think you're probably enjoying as much as I do. There's something called an unconditioned stimulus, right? And that's the lion, right? And prehistoric, the saber-toothed tiger, right? And this unconditioned, so we can actually replace the word unconditioned with the word unlearned. It means we don't have to learn to run away from a saber-toothed tiger or, you know, the modern lion. And the word lion really replaces, and this is not for you because I know you know all of this, but this is for our listeners.
Explanation is great. Yeah, keep it going.
The lion is whatever is life-threatening. So it's the experience of being raped in the moment. It's gunfire, bullets coming towards you. It's, you know, being in the middle of a tsunami. It's being in the middle of a domestic violence, you know, death threat or attempt, right? It's the moment of true life threat. That's what we call an unconditioned stimulus. It means it's an unlearned, unpredictable, just environmental thing that shows up and might have the potential of killing you, right? And we will always, as long as we perceive that threat, we will always have what we call an unconditioned response. That unconditioned response is the fight, flight, freeze response, which is the sympathetic nervous system or the sympathetic nervous branch of the autonomic nervous system. So autonomic, I help my patients understand that as opposed to the voluntary musculoskeletal system, there's an autonomic system, automatic, right? It's the things that kind of keep you alive, like blinking, breathing. It'd be pretty bad if we were like, okay, take a breath. Okay, breathe it out. We wouldn't have any other problems in life, right? Because every cell of our body would be trying to remember to blink, to breathe, to swallow. You know? So this autonomic system is always being run by one of two systems, either one or two branches, either the parasympathetic, right? In medical school, we learned it's the sit and shit, or if you want to be nice about it, the rest and digest, the feed and breathe system. It's the stuff you don't need to be working if you're running from a lion. And then there's the sympathetic nervous system. It has sympathy for us. It wants us to survive. So that's the fight, flight, freeze. I think I don't know how old you are, but you're young. So I'm about to turn 50. But I remember in school, you know, decades ago, it was just called the fight or flight. But in the past couple decades, there has been a lot of research on the freeze part of this. And even more specifically, things called, for example, tonic immobility, which is a freeze response that's so extreme that an animal can play dead and actually stops breathing for seconds at a time. And so it's fascinating. There's a lot of new research. And now we know it's not just the fight or flight. And so more old school folks that were trained under that part of the science, scientific knowledge will say, you know, it's kind of like people who still say, shell shock, right? It's just now we know it as fight, flight, freeze. And so this will happen, right? If there's a lion, but because of the hippocampus and the ARC protein, that's like the scribe, the note taker, what happens is while we're in that life-threatening situation, our structures in our limbic system kind of kick into gear and they're like, oh shit, I should take notes, right? Vegas, 10 o'clock, Sunday, turf, noise, lights, shooting, country music, Jason Aldean, country boots, right? And even down to like the climate, the temperature. And so, you know, you're taking notes. The problem is from that moment on, everything that you have now associated with that lion becomes a potential trigger. Right. And those triggers, we call those conditioned stimuli, because now conditioned meaning learned. Right. I mean, I had to learn from that experience that when I see turf, I think of Vegas. To this day, I do. I don't have any physiological reaction anymore. I don't feel that sickness when I see it, or necessarily think pool of blood anymore. But I swear to you, I never spent more, I mean, I don't think it's normal to think about faked, like fake grass as much as I've thought about fake grass in the past couple of years. So, but you know, I had to learn that because prior to Route 91, turf was just turf. And I thought, oh yeah, sporting events, you know, when you, California water conscientiousness, right? I didn't have any other associations with it. But the problem is now, you know, this one lion has all of these, as one of my patients called it, stringers, right? It's like all these connecting points to all these completely unrelated, but now triggering stimuli. And then what happens is for every stimulus, there is a response. So now we call the responses to those stimuli conditioned responses because they are learned responses. And what are those responses? Well, you start having panic attacks because now that conditioned set of stimuli turn into a story, a trauma narrative. And the story is, I can't go to Vegas. I can't go to anywhere near high-rise hotels. Noises are dangerous. Crowds are dangerous. I'll have a meltdown if I listen to Jason Aldean or I put my cowboy boots on or, you know, I go on a trip, you know, and on and on and on. And so what do? Because of that anxiety, that story, this very irrational and inaccurate and unhelpful, unhealthy story, it will cause a lot of anxiety. Because now we're catastrophizing and we're fortune telling and we're mind reading. And it will lead to a set of avoidance behaviors because all animals want to avoid what hurts. So, you know, if you burn yourself on fire, you're going to try to avoid fire from now on. The problem is not that we avoid fire. It's that we start, you know, let's say you get burned on the stove. The problem is now we avoid food, we avoid the stove, we avoid the kitchen, we avoid anybody who's talking about fire or stoves or cooking or kitchens or food. And then it turns into PTSD, right? That's essentially what PTSD is. And with that anxiety, if just to kind of turn this into this bit, this story of the domino effect, when you have chronic anxiety, inevitably you will likely develop some depressive symptoms because feeling helpless and powerless for so long will lead you to feel suddenly very, very hopeless. And then when you're hopeless and you're depressed, you isolate, right? Isolation and avoidance sometimes can look the same, but not always. And then of course that, you know, anger is a very seductive emotion because it gives us this false sense of power. But anger doesn't live alone. Anger is often the socialized, especially for men, it is the socialized and socially acceptable emotion. So that anger and irritability, what does that do? It alienates us. Nobody wants to be around, you know, an angry person. So now here we are with avoidance and isolation and alienation, and we're not sleeping well, right? And so then we might start drinking or using, you know, or misusing or abusing substances to help us sleep or avoid. And then we're not socializing. And now we're in more chronic pain, and headaches and migraines are associated with anxiety and depression. And you can see how this can turn into a big hot mess of symptoms. And essentially, the reason that people end up with PTSD has nothing to do with the unconditioned stimulus or the unconditioned response. That's just normal, hardwired, what we do. It's actually the set of conditioned stimuli and responses that turn into this chronic mental illness. And so, you know, when you understand this, it's like the sky, the heavens open up and the angels sing because you realize, oh, so all I have to do is separate, detach those conditioned stimuli from the lion so that I don't run away every time I see something with teeth or yellow or with fur or, you know, that make a noise, because then you'd be running away from cats, from your kittens, right? Mm-hmm. But kittens are not the same thing as lions or saber-toothed tigers. Mm-hmm. And that distinction, we call that discrimination. Discrimination is very, very important for us to maintain health and also for us to be able to properly perceive danger and know the difference between danger and non-danger that may just in some ways resemble danger, right? Kind of back to, we can only focus on so much when we're in a really life-threatening situation. So let's make sure we're focusing on the right stuff, right? So it's not actually helpful if we're super hyper-vigilant about everything, because if you're, you know, in another life-threatening situation and you're like lion, 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 then, you know, you could actually die because you can't tell the difference. Yep. So once we tell a different story, and then we stop avoiding, stop isolating, start talking about things, stop drinking, start really facing and processing this experience and grieving the loss. Maybe it's the loss of your sense of trust when you're out in public. Okay, you grieve it. You try to come to a more reasonable thought process at the end of it, which is, okay, not necessarily always safe. There are a lot of moving parts in the world, but I'm also not always in danger, right? And that was something in my own healing. In those trips back to Vegas, the first few back, I remember being in the airport and just thinking, like, my automatic thoughts just went to, okay, if a bomb goes off, where am I going to run? Just automatically thinking there's going to be a bomb. There's going to, you know, in the plane, we're going to crash. Although I will tell you a funny thing. The flight back from Vegas, I was sitting next to a guy who was not a Route 91 survivor. He had not been to the concert. He went to like some EDM concert, right? And it was one of the bumpiest flights I've ever been on. And he was just clenching the armrest, and he was nervous. And he said something like, oh God, I feel like we're going to crash. And I looked at him and I said, we're not going to crash. Don't worry. I didn't survive that shooting just to crash in an airplane. And, you know, half the plane was survivors because we were all going back on that Monday afternoon. But it was just a natural thought process in that first few months. It was like your brain just kind of automatically thinks, okay, aside from the hypervigilance and startling from noises and lights and stuff, you just kind of go there, you know? Mm-hmm. And you know, thankfully that goes away because I kept reminding myself, okay, you know what? This was like the most random event. And sure, random things happen, but it's not likely that every time I go out, every time I go to Vegas, every time I go to a concert, there's going to be a massacre. Like, the chances are very, I would say before this past couple of years, I would have said zero, right? Well, I think it probably was zero. I don't know if we had anybody who had been through two mass shootings, right, in a lifetime. But now I can't say that because mass shootings have just increased. And, you know, there have been people who have actually, experienced two in a lifetime so far. So,
yeah.
It's all about the story, Nick, you know, learning how to tell a narrative that is helpful, that is balanced. It's not about being Pollyanna. It's not about like being all roses and sunshine and everything is good and everybody's good and I'll never, ever get into this situation again. That's not realistic either, but it's about having a balanced story,
right?
You know? That's how we stay healthy, because neutral thoughts and stories lead to neutral feelings, lead to neutral behaviors.
There's a statement that I often find myself saying to students when the question comes up, how can you take a stimulus, like TERF, that has become conditioned and associated with the unconditioned stimulus? How can you, create an extinction of the conditioned response, as it's called, or how can you disassociate it from the unconditioned stimulus and render it just a neutral thing again? Right. And the statement, I think, kind of captures it, which is repeated exposure to the conditioned stimulus independent of the unconditioned stimulus reduces the conditioned response. So the more times you see TERF without also being shot at,
Exactly.
Yeah. So
articulated, Nick, perfectly articulated. The way I kind of sell this to my patients is, you know, because they're coming in because they have chronic symptoms now. maybe not all PTSD, other trauma disorders or anxiety or mood disorders. But I tell them, look, conditioned learning got you in the hole. Mm-hmm. Corrective learning is going to get you out of the hole, mm-hmm. right? And that's kind of the sort of easy way of articulating what you just explained, right? Which is repeated exposure. And actually, there's even a formula for it. In therapy, it's 3 times a week, mm-hmm. 1 hour minimum, not using safety objects, right? And so it is potentially a deliberate decision to go into this environment that you know might be triggering, but to not use any safety objects or safety people or dogs or pills or anything else, mm-hmm. and to allow yourself to be in that exposure setting, have a panic attack if your anxiety gets that high, and stay there anyway, mm-hmm. right? Basically, I feel like I'm constantly giving my patients permission to go have a miserable fucking experience, mm-hmm. and just be miserable and have a full-blown panic attack and stay anyway, mm-hmm. right? And that's one of the bucket rules. But it is really, behavioral exposure strategies are amazing. Yeah. And they are miraculous for people who have any kind of anxiety disorder, whether it is under the umbrella of trauma or obsessive, like OCD, or generalized anxiety or phobias. Phobias are particularly easy to treat, but exposure. And so, you know, and there was a part of me going through my own recovery, Nick, that I was just curious. As an academic and intellectual and as a therapist, you know, specialized in this, it was like almost as though I was sort of observing myself going through this. You know, there was like part of me who was just in it, experiencing it. But then there was another part of me who was like, that's really curious. That's really interesting that happened. That's really interesting. I wonder if this is going to happen again, right? But not in a catastrophic, like, oh my God, it's going to happen again. But just in a sort of, I'm observing mindfully. I'm just noticing it. I'm not judging it, right? And that's essentially, these are the same sets of tools that help people heal, right? Is learning how to be compassionate, learning how to be mindful, learning how to really thought challenge and identify when they have errors of thought. And they are generalizing, or they are engaging in all or nothing or black and white thinking, or they are catastrophizing, you know, stuff like that.
I want to get to your bucket rules, which I think are so good. And I even have a favorite.